Poetry on the radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, Canberra-based poet K.A. Nelson, plus The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. For ArtSound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. K.A. Nelson grew up in Mudgee, left school at 15, learned shorthand and typing at a technical institute, and traveled for a decade. Then she studied at Sydney Teachers College and the University of New England. With a diploma of teaching and a bachelor's degree in English literature and drama, she moved to the Australian desert. Over the years, she has lived and worked in New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Italy, the Northern Territory, and Canberra. After working for 3 decades in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs, she returned to studies at the University of Canberra, writing a memoir with poetry as part of master's degree by research. She won the Overland Literary Journal's Judith Wright Poetry Prize for New and Emerging Poets and published Inlandia from Recent Work Press in 2018, evoking her life in inland Australia. It was runner-up in the ACT Writer Center Book Awards for Poetry in 2019. In Meaty Bones, also from Recent Work Press, 2023, she expresses her concerns about the natural world and various aspects of contemporary Australian society. She often collaborates with visual artists, as we'll hear in 2 installments of Poetry on the Radio. Let's begin by hearing K.A. Nelson read the opening poem in her collection, Meaty Bones, and about her interest in the visual arts.
Meaty Bones. One of my father's professions, tobacconist. He packed the shelves of his barbershop with every brand of cigarette, tobacco, pipes, lighters, smoked Benson and Hedges. He moved my copy of a book on big tobacco from the counter to a drawer beneath the cash register. Mum, open to data and arguments, quit, but it took a cardiologist to convince Dad to stop smoking. It was just one more bone of contention we liked to chew. And oh, how we loved those meaty bones.
We asked K.A. Nelson about the covers of Inlandia and Meaty Bones.
I think even the cover of Meaty Bones says that in some ways it extends a lot of the themes from Inlandia, so I thought it would make sense to discuss them together.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm glad you think that, because I take a lot of time with my covers. And normally Shane has a lot to do with the covers of the books that he publishes. But with the first one, it's a close-up of a tea towel of a very good friend of mine that I've known for a long, long time. She was in the Mother's Club in Alice Springs, and an artist, very good artist, Jan Mackay. And with the second one, I saw an exhibition in Alice Springs, a ceramics exhibition, a travelling exhibition, and a local one at the same time. And my friend Tara Leckie had bones like that, not that one, but she had bones in that exhibition. And I just thought, wow, that's fantastic. And I was writing the book at the time, and I thought, wow, I think I'll get in touch with her and ask her if she would make me one using the colour of old blood. And she agreed.
Oh, it's very visceral. I love the title because, of course, it's a little bit ironic, right, to have a meaty bone. But at the same time, they're both meaty books. They're both a little bit on the longer side for poetry books. And they contain so much. One of the things I love most is just starting with Meaty Bones and, you know, opening it, and straight away, there's all these women. It's really a book full of women. And I would say it's a book full of women who aren't often represented in writing.
Yeah, it is full of women. I make sure of that. Being a woman of a certain age, I've got a lot of women in the background of my life, and a lot of Aboriginal women as well, who have taught me so much. And so It's also a book of gratitude in a way for everything that they've taught me and shared.
So it starts with the three poems, The Peacemaker, At the Single Woman's Camp, and Why I Keep a Digging Stick Under My Pillow, which is a fascinating poem, I think. And that's the way we come into this book, right? It's just, and no poem is alike. I mean, they're all free verse, but they're structured quite differently. The second one, At the Single Woman's Camp, being a prose poem. So I wondered if you would read Why I Keep a Digging Stick.
Why I Keep a Digging Stick Under My Pillow. Some men want to hurt us. Men who have the strength and cunning to break in. Sometimes in twos, threes, whole platoons. And sometimes, after taking everything, these men want to rub it in. Even though the point of my digging stick could penetrate flesh without effort, the thick end may, with a minimum of fuss, knock a man out, crack a skull, shatter bone. This isn't the main reason I keep a digging stick under my pillow. The heft of memory when I touch its polished hardwood takes me back to a chase across country, running with women, goanna going to ground, women digging, dirt flying, the whack and burning flesh, our greasy fingers. Oh, the freight of dreams rumbling north on a two-lane highway, swags under stars, the company of women around fire, sparks flying. How we redesign the Milky Way, reshape the whole bloody universe.
What strikes me about this poem, it's on the one page. It fills the whole page. First two stanzas are on the left. Left justified, and then the last three stanzas are right justified. So there's real movement, intentional movement with it. And it covers this huge ground, both literally and figuratively, yes?
Yes. And really, you know, it's to highlight that the world that we live in is a bit of a snake pit for women. And these women in the desert, once they get over the whole childbearing thing and get into ceremony and teaching others, they don't care about anything else, as far as I'm concerned. The way that they've taught me, they live at the single women's camp, for example. If their husbands have died or whatever, they're not really looking for anything else except ceremony, trips to country, all that sort of stuff. So being part of that in the second stanza, such a joy sitting around the fire, swags under stars in the company of women. It's beautiful. It's a lovely experience.
It's a lovely image, you know. The first line of the poem is, some men want to hurt us. And then, and cunning to break in sometimes in twos, threes. So starts with this, individual, right? The threat.
That's right.
And by the end of the poem, we've got the whole bloody universe. I mean, it really opens up.
Well, I would really like to redesign the whole bloody universe, wouldn't you?
Sure. Happy to. But I don't know. It strikes me only now, as you say that maybe that's what poets do, one poem at a time.
Hopefully.
Would you read At the Single Women's Camp? Since
sure.
You mentioned it, and it's right there on the opposite side.
At the Single Women's Camp. Molly, Biddy, Addie, Bess and May don't care about the grey beards sprouting from their chins. They couldn't give a wild fig about their matted hair, old scars. They had fought and won their battles in the 1980s, their land. They burn wood, hot wire seeds for necklaces, paint dots on canvases marking time. They're laughing at the antics of the dogs, or one more white fella who comes with questions, other kinds of wanting. In their small circle behind this fence, they've finished mothering. They're mostly silent now and wise. Their only wish, a decent feed, a lift to country when things are ripe. Wild passion fruit, bush tomatoes, ininti seeds. Let the young ones hunt echidna and goanna. After all their gathering, these women are content to sit, sip tea, eat what we've packed in eskies or a box, They've stopped bleeding, crying, caring, wanting anything except trips to country, ceremony. Look, Molly, Biddy, Addy, Bess and May are painted up. The ochre patterns on their bodies map their country. See how they gently stamp their feet and sway? Listen, they're singing up hills and soaks and dreaming sites with bare-breasted dignity, knowing limbs, ochre lines and circles, the language of the land. Each woman's body is their country, a songline they pass on to younger women, kin.
That poem gives us such a glimpse into a place most of us don't get to see into. And one of the things I love is how it's specific, how it names things. In so many cultures, the naming of something brings it to life.
I've known lots of Mollies, Biddies, Addies, Besses and May, so they're not any one person.
Mm-hmm.
They're multiple women that I've met over 40 years.
That's what I imagined.
Yeah.
But I mean, even the way it names the animals, the goanna, it's specific.
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. And it also sort of leads me to think, even though this is a separate book, the book from 2018, Inlandia, right, in the title of it, this idea that you're writing about a place. When you think of Australia, quite often people think of the beaches and the oceans and maybe the snowy mountains, right? You're writing about a place that is landlocked, and
choosing the name of this book was very conscious.
Mm.
I wanted it to celebrate how creative I feel when I'm in the desert.
Mm.
And in Central Australia or anywhere, either on community or in Alice Springs. And, you know, I love going to the beach. I love being in the water.
Mm.
But I've nearly always lived inland, not near the beach. Mm. Beach to me is holiday. Having grown up in Mudgee by a river, the beach is a holiday place.
Peter Searles asked.
And it was your career that meant that you had the opportunity to live in these inland places, isn't that right? Could you give us a bit of background about the work that you were doing, what took you out there, and then how living there has continued to influence the poetry that you're writing?
It's quite a long story, but I'll try and cut it down a little bit. When I was in high school, I saw a film advertising a course for young men to go to Papua New Guinea via ASOPA, which is the Australian School of Pacific Studies in Sydney. And I thought, oh, wow, that'd be great. I'd love to do that. And, of course, they wanted young men. But that germ of an idea about Papua New Guinea, it just looks so different to the life that I was leading. Anyway, I thought I must go there one day. Anyway, I have found my way there with my partner, who was a school teacher, and I lived and worked in Papua New Guinea right around independence. And up there I was engaging with all sorts of people from all over the world, as well as the local people. And they were, the expatriates were very, they were very well trained. They mostly had masters or PhDs. They were in agriculture, they were in geology, they were in teaching. They were in every kind of profession that you could think of, and they were all professionals. Then our contracts finished in Papua New Guinea and we went to Lajamanu, an Aboriginal community in the Northern Territory. And as in this book, I suffered culture shock. I had never suffered culture shock in Papua New Guinea. But in the Aboriginal community, I could not believe the living conditions of the people there, the differences in the attitudes and professionalism of the white fella people that were working there. And so my desire to go back to the Pacific and work there was kind of thwarted in one year by Lajamanu, the Lajamanu experience. And in the end, I just stayed working in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander domain.
So that culture shock, rather than making you feel you wanted to go back to something else, actually made you want to stay there?
It did. In the first 3 months, it made me want to run for my life. And then they have this the local people have this way of getting into your bloodstream and into your brain. And, you know, you're either open to it or you're not. Mm. And I was certainly open to it, and they sucked me right in.
When I read the poem Induction from your book, yeah, Inlandia, it reads a bit like kind of like a guide to people to navigate that kind of experience in that kind of community where they're experiencing culture shock. And there's a line in there that I just wondered if you might explain a bit. When you said, learn the lingo, it is by far the best way to understanding everything. What
yes,
did you mean?
That line, I was only reading that the other day and I thought, I might change that next time. Or when I read it again, I might change that. Because that line, eat well, learn the lingo, it is by far the best way to understanding something, is what I would change it to. Because I don't think you can ever understand everything in another culture at all. And all these cultures are so different. If you move between the cultures, you'll never understand everything. But, you know, you try and understand a lot.
I'm smiling because the line 2 lines later, or the sentence 2 lines later, because it's a prose poem. As for going native, don't be that kind of schmuck.
Yeah, that's right.
And the word choice there of schmuck is just brilliant, because you're pulling from neither language or neither, you know.
It's a good word, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Yiddish, right? So it comes out of nowhere. I love that.
Yeah.
And it is. It's a fabulous word.
And I think, you know, that line, I've seen people who go out there and just, you know, especially men, that they go and they do the men's business and they, you know, they try and go over. They try and cross the culture and become Aboriginal. I have never wanted to do that. I've never understood why people want to do that. I don't think it's possible. As I say in the last line there, you know, a full transition is impossible, and it's not your mission. It's nearly always viewed with suspicion, and that comes from Craig Storti's book itself. It's always viewed with suspicion by compatriots and hosts alike. It's best to meet halfway your other half, and I think that's what I've been trying to do for the last 40 years.
I think it's fascinating to end it on those words, your other half.
That's right. They're my other half.
But it's a little bit of a mystery, right? The idea is discover it. It's a bit of an invitation at the end. Figure this out.
Yeah, be open.
Yeah.
Peter Monahan asked,
as you say, there are plenty of people who presume too much, and most of us don't presume anything. Don't take that initiative to find out what the country is, has been for a long time.
Well, if only, you know, part of the reason I do write about it is because I'm trying to encourage people, to white people, to be open and to go and find out, even if it's about your local area. You can do lots of stuff to educate yourself. And I don't think Australians do that very well at all, as you can see from the referendum results. And most people, most white people, just get on with their lives and their careers and their big houses and whatnot and their holidays and all that sort of stuff. And they don't realise what rich cultural other languages and art and everything is available to us. If only we'd embrace it, we'd be so much richer.
Yeah, since I read this and I knew that you had those kind of experiences, I wanted to know, what was your take on the referendum result? Do you think it's a desire for white people to just ignore the problems that are going on? Was there more to it?
I think the referendum result was foretold when Dutton came out and said he wasn't going to give bipartisan support. And when I've talked about it with all my friends, they've said, oh, well, you know, Albo shouldn't have gone with it. You know, there was one step prior to that. So the whole thing was political, I think. Who's to blame? I think Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people kind of pushed the referendum, and there's been so much work, at least 15 years work up to that referendum and constitutional recognition. I think you need to talk to people like Megan Davis and Mr. Mayo, Thomas Mayo, who and Kerry O'Brien for a better answer. But, you know, I think Australia is still a pretty racist country, and I think that was political. I think it's multifaceted, and I was very disappointed, but I think the good thing I thought came out of it was that, okay, it reinforced that I live in a place that said yes, that's great. And nearly all but one of the mobile units in the Northern Territory voted yes. And so that completely debunked Jacinta Nambujimpa's Price's thesis about everything. And but it was still a very disappointing result and a terrible time in the history of our relationship.
Do you see the poem as a political act?
Absolutely.
Well, lots of poets don't feel comfortable with that assertion, I guess.
Well, the opening poem in this book was a very deliberate choice as an opening poem.
In Meaty Bones.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's right. Really, I wanted to put some context around our relationship with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Before the referendum, this book came out in July. This book was a referendum book for white fellas, mm-hmm. mostly. The first, bringing Oodaroo Noonuccal into the equation with her very hopeful poem called Song of Hope was to contextualise the referendum and say, this is what hope looks like for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Please give it to them. The Peacemaker. I watched this woman walk into a battle silent and unarmed, saw her take the weapons from her warring clan of women. Unasked, she came to help when redback spiders overran the building. After whirlwinds, she helped tidy up the yard. We could not speak each other's language. Our bodies leant towards each other in handshakes, nods and smiles. Sometimes we sat together on her country. Through an interpreter, she told stories, pointed out two distant peaks as a woman's place, then painted it for me. We gathered aninti beans together, shared food, arm in arm, many borders frayed. That year, I had Oodaroo Noonuccal's poetry by my bedside, learnt her poem, Song of Hope, by heart. I asked if it could be translated for the Peacemaker. Once heard, she thought the glad tomorrow, Oodaroo Noonuccal's last line in that verse, might be a first line in another song, one for this new century.
It's interesting. It's the beginning poem. It's like already straight away the olive branch or the bridge is being constructed. And
I think that phrase, the glad tomorrow, that's had a lot of meaning for me. You know, I think this poem is about her hopes for the future. Mm. And if you read that poem, it's 4 or 5 stanzas and it's all very hopeful. And I think, damn it, it hasn't really come to that glad tomorrow yet. Mm-hmm. And when I did my master's, the memoir part of it was called Searching for the Glad Tomorrow.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. That's cool. Your copy of Inlandia that you have here is missing the front cover, and it's also missing pieces of the first few pages. And there's a story there, yes?
There is a bit of a story to that. Back in 2018, when the book was first published, I'd just completed a collaboration with my friend Kate Waite, who's an artist who lived in South Australia, around the Flinders Ranges. And she lived in an old schoolhouse in a ghost town. And but we were going to have an exhibition and a poetry launch at Burra. So I sent down a box of books that they could, because I didn't go to that opening, but I sent down a box of books for her to be able to sell, and she put them on her veranda. And it was a time of a great drought, and the kangaroos were really hungry. And one night they jumped up on the veranda, opened the box and started eating the books. And I just use it as my copy because it just, I think it's just a lovely reminder that, you know, a kangaroo might have wanted to open the pages of this book.
You know, when people say, oh, poetry's not my thing, well, it's many things, isn't it?
You pointed out, Kerry, that a lot of people who go to Central and Northern Australia presume too much, or they impose in various ways. They are unable to, I guess, let go of their own cultural formation sufficiently to see what's there and to be empathetic towards it. You've had this long process of coming to some sort of point where you can faithfully represent both yourself as an outsider and the people that you knew as the inlanders. Do you have to think about that when you write, or is that just who you've become?
Don't be fooled. I still make mistakes. And it's been a long, long, long process of making mistakes. And but I think the thing that really helped me in both Papua New Guinea and later was I grew up in a very small town with a very large extended family of all sorts of personalities and, you know, glitches and, you know, all sorts of things going on. And, you know, I think that was the real working ground for my basic personality of being open and not being afraid of the other, but embracing. You know, I've always loved difference, and that whole experience, seven years in Papua New Guinea, was just such a seminal experience for me. I think I did all my growing up in Papua New Guinea, apart from my childhood in that small country town.
Next week, we'll talk more with K.A. Kerry Nelson about her small town roots, the time she spent in various parts of the world, and how they shaped her poetry. For Art Sound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. At Smith's Alternative in Civic on Monday, April 1 at 7 p.m, Jeff's Poetry presents Cat Kid, Jackie Malins, and Natalie Damjanovich Napoleon. Cat Kid, a key figure in the Montreal cabaret scene since the 1990s, is best known for her zoology-inspired solo shows Sea Peach and Hyena Subpoena. At the National Folk Festival of 2023, she was named Reciter of the Year. Jackie Malins is a performance poet and artist based on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country, who has created the poetry shows Matter of Life, Words in Flight, and Cavorting with Time. Her first full collection of poetry, F-Words, was published in 2021 by Recent Work Press. She directed the 2023 Poetic City Festival in Canberra. Natalie Damjanovich Napoleon was raised on a farm by her Croatian immigrant parents and now lives in Fremantle. She has won the Bruce Dorr and KSP Poetry Prizes and has been shortlisted for the Peter Porter Poetry Prize. Her debut collection, First Blood, appeared in 2019, and her second poetry book, If There Is a Butterfly That Drinks Tears, is out now from Life Before Man Gazebo Books. While in Canberra, she'll visit us at Poetry on the Radio, and we'll hear that interview in the coming weeks. On Monday, April 8 at 7 p.m, That Poetry Thing at Smith's Alternative presents the launch of Mary Andrews' Holds Up When Shattered from Kith Books and current work by Sandra Renew. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly in the studios of Art Sound FM in Canberra on unceded traditional land. Hosts Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles create the program with producer Peter Monaghan. Poetry on the Radio is heard each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope, performed by the Atrium Musica de Madrid.
Art Sound FM, your music and arts companion,